Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Atakramena vistaratas tataiva tatparyam nirnetum sambandhabideya prayojaneshu shadvik sandarbhair nirneshyamaneshu pratamam yasya vachya vachakata sambandidam shastram tadeva dharma projitakaitavok ityadipadye samanya karatas tavad aha vedyam vastavam atravastu iti tikacha. Tikacha shimati sundari bhagavate vastavam paramarta bhutam vastu vedyam natu vaisheshikari vad dravya gunadi rupam ityesha Sri Veda Vyasaha. To definitively establish the purport of Srimad Bhagavatam as outlined above, the six Sandarbhas set forth in detail the topics one after another of Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayojana. To begin with, in the verse Dharma Projitakaitava, the words Vedyam Vastavam Atravastu discuss in general terms the truth with which this scripture has a relationship. A relationship between what is to be described and that which describes it. Sridhar Swami. Of course, Dharma Projitakaitava is the second verse of the Bhagavatam. Sridhar Swami, in his commentary on this verse, says, in this opulent, beautiful Bhagavatam, the object to be known is that which is of real substance, transcendental worth, not the relative entities, such as physical matter and its qualities, described by the Vaisheshikas and others. The verse under discussion was spoken by Sri Vedavyasa. So this is Tattva Sandarbha. It talks about, after establishing the authority of the Bhagavatam, it tells us what the Bhagavatam says about the Supreme Truth in most general terms. So this is about as general a statement as you can get. The very second verse of the Bhagavatam talks in very general terms about Vastavam Vastu, the reality which is substantial substance, something real. Okay, commentary. Srimad Bhagavatam claims that at its very outset in the second verse that it will describe the absolute truth in a readily understandable way. Vedyam. This is what form? What grammatical form? Vedya? What's it called? Tavya? Yet. It has another name too, doesn't it? Vishnu something? Vishnu Kritya. And what's the meaning of it? What's the definition of it? The sutra that defines it? Okay, so there are several meanings. One of the meanings should. One of the meanings is able. So when we say Vedya, it doesn't mean that you have to, you know, you're enjoined, you're ordered to understand it. That doesn't make too much sense. Understand it or else. No, it means it's understandable. Okay, understandable. It means it can be understood. If you don't want to understand it, that's your business. but you can't understand it. Yes?
Can you understand Atra in this book?
Yeah, yeah. Yes. Well, Atra, yeah, Atra is the Adhikarana of the whole statement. Such and such is happening in this book. It's about the Bhagavatam. The statement is about the Bhagavatam. In this Bhagavatam, there can be understood. You don't have to understand it. You can look at the Bhagavatam with your eyes closed or something, or read it upside down, or not pay attention to it. But you can, if you make a proper effort, you may understand the absolute truth, the real substance. At this point, the Bhagavatam characterizes the supreme tattva in the most general way possible, by distinguishing it from other secondary truths. Vastavam vastu, the real substance, may be a vague definition of the supreme. But since the Bhagavatam in its 12-canto narration will develop a much more complete picture of the summum bonum, it can afford to follow this strategy. One implication of the definition vastavam vastu is that in contrast to Bhagavad Dharma, other religious and philosophical teachings are less substantial. Okay, Bhagavatam is doing this at the very beginning, talking in most general terms about the absolute truth. How long does this go on before the Bhagavatam gets specific about what the absolute truth is? You could say it's implied in the questions, but in the very first chapter, they're talking about Krishna and his incarnations. Yeah. Tell us about Krishna's incarnation. So you can tell from the questions of the sages that that's what they consider should be the discussion of the Bhagavatam. Most importantly, Krishna and his pastimes. Apart from that, though, because that's just questions, as far as the answers, where do we start getting specific in the Bhagavatam? Yeah, like where do we really start specifically identifying the absolute truth? And what's said? Okay, yes. Then it's specified that there's three understandings, Brahman, Paramatma, and... And then, where does it get more specific? Third chapter, Krishna's to Bhagavan Swayam. We identified Brahma, Bhagavan as the third, or the, you know, the last word in the absolute truth. But Krishna is the ultimate Bhagavan. So Bhagavatam doesn't stay unspecific very long. And if you can understand... Could you open the door? Sorry. If you understand the implication of the questions the sages are asking in the very first chapter, you get a very specific idea even then. Okay, continuing the commentary. The Vaisheshika philosophy established in the sutras of Kanada Rishi is a sophisticated analysis of reality through a system of seven ontological categories: substance, dravya; quality, guna; movement, karma; generality, jati. What's a generality? Give me an example. Well, not cow, but cowness. Gotvam. The cow is specific, but the cowness is general. Okay. Yes, I'm sorry?
Universality.
You want to call it that. You can call it, but it's not really general. It's not universal. Otherwise, everything would be a cow if it was universal. Yeah, okay, well, within the universe of cows, it's universal. But I don't like that so much because it's misleading. It sounds like everything's a cow. It's too philosophical, you know, too scholarly. People don't talk like that. Generality, that's four. Substance, quality, movement, generality, individuality, vishesha, inheritance, samavaya, and absence, abhava. These are the categories that the Vaisheshika philosophy divides everything up into. Just like modern chemistry has 113, a lot of elements, over 100. Here there's six basic elements or categories of existence. Of course, Non-existence is one of the categories. That one was added on later. Kanada himself doesn't talk about abhava, but the later followers decided it was required. We don't follow that philosophy exactly, although we do make use of some of its methods. We don't agree with it completely. Okay, continuing. According to Kanada, the various elements of matter give rise to objects in which qualities, colors, shapes, qualities, namely colors, shapes, and so on, and various kinds of movements reside by so-called inherence. In other words, by inseparably accompanying those objects. Through inherence, inseparable means that the pot could exist without a color. According to Vaisheshika philosophy, the clay is a certain color, and when it's baked in the oven, it changes color. But according to them, for some crazy reason, if anything, any quality or any feature of a thing changes, then it's not the same thing anymore. It should be considered a different thing. So the clay-colored pot actually gets destroyed by the fire, and the atoms reassemble into a different pot with a different color. That's what they say. Because the color change means the thing went out of existence and came back into existence in a different form. In here, that means not that the pot only exists as long as the color does, because that's their theory says the opposite. The pot can give up one color and take another one. No, right, they said none. I'm sorry, another pot does go out of existence. Anyway, that's it. The thing that inheres only exists as inhering in it. The cloth inheres in the threads. Not the other way around. You'd think the threads are inside the cloth. Okay, they're physically in, you know, they're ingredients of the cloth, but that's not what inherence means. Inherence means the cloth inheres in the threads. The cloth can't exist without the threads. The threads can exist without the cloth. I can pull all the threads apart and I don't have a cloth anymore. I still have threads. But if I burn the threads or do something to them to destroy them, no cloth anymore. So the cloth is dependent on the threads for its existence. That's inherence. The cloth inheres in the threads. The cloth can only exist as long as the threads are there. Okay, so qualities inhere in things, in substances. Substance just means a thing, a physical thing, like a ball that's red. Now, why do we say that the red inheres in the ball, which would mean that the red color can't exist without the ball? What do you mean? I've got, you know, a whole bucket of paint exactly that color, and I've got some other item that's also the same color. Why do you say the color goes out, you know, can't exist without the ball? Or goes out of existence if the ball goes out of existence? Because another assumption of the Vaisheshikas is that each thing's quality is unique. The red of this ball is not the same red of the other thing that's red. I don't know why they say that, but each set of qualities that a thing has are unique to that thing. And you may have another color that looks the same, but that's because they both colors have color redness in them. The redness is the same, but the red is a separate red for each red thing. Okay, so yeah, if the ball is destroyed, it's atomized and goes out of existence, then the red color of that ball doesn't exist anymore. Something else may be red, but the color of that ball isn't there anymore because the ball isn't there anymore. So the color in here is the qualities in here in substances. And so do motions. Okay, somebody's walking down the street, and then the Martians zap him with a ray gun, and he's vaporized. He doesn't exist anymore. So if he doesn't exist anymore, his walking doesn't exist anymore either. The motion of a thing can't exist without the thing existing. So the motions in here in things also. Anyway, that's their theory. That's the quality of inherence, or rather the relationship of inherence. It's a kind of connection between things. Another kind of connection that they recognize is simple contact. Atoms come together to make molecules, but it's not that one atom is inhering in another one. They're just touching each other. It's just physical contact. That's another kind of connection or contact, physical contact. And a more intimate one is inherence. The cloth is contacting the threads by inhering in the threads. Okay. Through inherence, the particular redness of an individual red clay pot exists only as long as the pot exists, though there may be many similar red clay pots which share the natural general features, jatis, of potness, clayness, and redness. Atoms, Kanada says, are the ultimate components of gross matter, and each individual atom is different from all the others because inherent within itself is its own individuality. See, this is that other category, vishesha. Okay, you got atoms. You got atoms of fire. Atoms don't have color because they're infinitesimal, infinitely small in size. They don't have any qualities. They don't have any visible qualities. They're imperceptible. So what's the difference between one atom and the next? What's the difference between one cow and the next? The cows may have slightly different qualities, but what if you get two cows who are identical twins, and they were given the same name, and there's nothing different about them, but they're two different cows. What's the difference? So to make a difference when there's no difference of qualities, this extra category called vishesha has to be postulated by the vaisheshikas. It means it's like a serial number. The cows may be all identical. Suppose you have a machine making identical machine parts. We have a machine making cows, and they all come out the same, an assembly line. But they're each given a serial number to identify them uniquely. So that's vishesha. Each thing has got its own stamp of vishesha, its uniqueness. Okay, atoms, Kanada says, are the ultimate components of gross matter, and each individual atom is different from all the others because inherent within itself is its own individuality, a special imperceptible entity, something like a unique serial number, worked out in detail. This Vaisheshika ontology was considered a useful enough model of reality to be borrowed from by theoreticians of other schools of traditional Indian thought. Vaishnava authors also use some Vaisheshika concepts, like Samavaya. Samavaya is that inherence relationship. To analyze physical existence, even though Badarayana Vyas, Veda Vyas, argued in the Vedanta Sutra the invalidity of conceiving of Samavaya as a special kind of relationship distinct from the more basic relationships of inclusion, as with a person and his hand, the hand is part of the body, and contact, as with atoms that together make up a molecule. They're just touching one another. Vaishnava authorities simply take advantage of what is practically useful adjusting their borrowed terms like samavaya to correct the mistakes in the way the terms are used in the original formulations. This borrowing is justified by the principle paramatam apratishindham anumatam. Parts of a rival theory that are not specifically contradicted are acceptable to adopt. So we can borrow from the Vaisheshika Nyaya schools what's useful, even though we oppose generally their way of looking at the world. Another concept is the Vishesha concept that's borrowed by the Vaishnavas. Madhvacharya talks about there are five different separate categories of existence. We hear about them in Baladeva Vidyabhushan's commentary, Govinda Bhasha. And we've discussed them coming up in Baladeva Vidyabhushan's commentary on the Tattvasandarbha. The first category is Ishvara. Within Ishvara, Ishvara is one without a second. He doesn't have any actual distinctions. He's one and unified. But he has the appearance of difference within him. So that appearance of difference, where there is no real difference, Madhvacharya uses that same term, vishesha. The speciality. The varieties within the Absolute Truth are called visheshas, because they're not material differences. There's no beta, but there's an appearance of beta. Baladeva Vidyabhushan, having been trained up in the Madhva school, and then having joined the Gaudiya Vaishnava Sampradaya, explains Lord Chaitanya's philosophy also in terms of vishesha. But there's a difference how it's used by Baladeva Vidyabhushan. Madhva says that vishesha is only found within Brahman himself. You know, that the jiva is altogether separate from Bhagavan, from Vishnu. But Chaitanya's teaching, and as it's presented by Baladeva Vidyabhushan, applies vishesha to the relationship between Brahman, or the personality of Godhead, and all of his energies. There's a vishesha relationship. Because we have the philosophy of simultaneous difference and non-difference. So there is no difference in a real sense, but there is appearance of difference. So when Baladeva Vidyabhushan talks about vishesha, he means there is vishesha between Brahman and all of his energies. But Madhva just says there's vishesha within Brahman himself, but he's separate from his energies. That's the difference between simplifying it, oversimplifying it. You can say that's the difference between Dvaita and Achintya Beta Beta. Then, when the other Goswamis talk about it, they use the term instead, Achintya Beta Beta. But this Vishesha, as it's used by Baladeva Vidyabhushan, and Achintya Beta Beta, as used by Rupa, Sanatana, and the others, they're synonymous. There's no difference between the concepts. Those who say that Baladeva Vidyabhushan is presenting a Madhvite philosophy, that's not exactly Lord Chaitanya's philosophy, that's wrong. At least it's wrong. I don't know why someone would say that, who's a follower of Lord Chaitanya, why someone would minimize the authority of Baladeva Vidyabhushan. He uses the term vishesha in such a way that it exactly corresponds to what the others mean by achintya beta beta. Anyway, originally the word was coined as a technical term in metaphysics by the Vaisheshikas. Okay, continuing the commentary. Ultimately, however, speculative thought can approach the truth with only relative success. The Supreme Tattva does not reveal himself to those unwilling to know him as the Supreme Person. And worldly interests, like acquiring assets and knowledge for their own sake, cloud the realization of the personality of Godhead, which can then be only partial. At the outset, outset. That means the very beginning. Srimad Bhagavatam 112 proclaims that it will avoid these distractions. Dharma projita kaitavotra. Here all deceptive ideas of religion are rejected. Although material progress and science are ordinarily considered honorable pursuits necessary for human advancement. The computer decided to go to sleep. One second. There's only nine students here. Is everybody else here or what? Three went to Delhi. Sick? Oh, okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Although material progress and science are ordinarily considered honorable pursuits necessary for human advancement, in the transcendental view of the Bhagavatam, they are detrimental when they pose as the actual goal of life and when spiritual culture is harnessed to their jaded purposes. In Srimad Bhagavatam, the absolute reality, Vastu, is presented as Vastava. That might be considered redundant. Vastava is simply an adjective formed out of the noun vastu. All it would normally mean is having the quality of a vastu. It's a vastu, it's like a vastu. It's a redundant statement, it's a tautology. But here's an explanation of what it can mean and not just be repetitious or redundant. In Srimad Bhagavatam, the absolute reality, Vastu, is presented as Vastava, meaning connected with everything related to him. So that's another meaning of Vastava. Vastava can be taken as a noun. What's connected to the Vastu can be called the Vastavam. So we're going to talk about, in this book, Bhagavatam, about the absolute truth, but also about all the things that are connected to him. His devotees, his personal form, his abode, his pastime activities. These are all Vastava because they're in relationship to the Vastu. It's not just, it's something, it's a substantial substance. That's not saying much. What is meant by that is more than that. According to Srila Sridhara Swami, the word Vastava indicates the Vastu's three principal expansions in this world. So here's the Vastavas. The Jivas, who are particles emanating from him. Maya, his ruling energy in this world. And his avatars, his advents in the physical cosmos. The six Sandarbhas show how Srimad Bhagavatam fully explains these and his other expansions. The last two Sandarbhas focus especially on the relationship of the Jivas with the Vastava Vastu in pure love, bhakti. The ultimate purpose of Srimad Bhagavatam is to reveal the science of prema bhakti. Okay, now, we were talking about the Vaisheshikas. Let's go back and re-identify why we mentioned them. Why did Jiva Goswami mention them? Because the Vaisheshikas talk about different kinds of tattvas. Relative tattva. They do a decent job of making a model that explains everything that exists in the world as we know it. Not only the concrete realities that physical sciences like chemistry and physics might explain, but also much more subtle phenomena, even the phenomenon of absence or non-existence. A good attempt is made at explaining all of that by the categories of Vaisheshika. But still, these are relative entities, material entities. And the vastu, the tattva, that is going to be described in the Bhagavatam is something of a whole different character. Transcendental absolute truth, which Vaisheshika and other mundane philosophies cannot even approach, begin to approach. Okay. Any discussion? Rambu?
They probably borrowed their model from earlier Vedic, certain Vedic model, because in the third canto, the third canto uses the terminology that they use for the basic atom, Paramanu, and their model that one atom makes two atoms and two double atoms or three double atoms make one hexatom.
Well, there's the common there's the concept of atom that shows up in the Bhagavatam, but that's just one element of the Vaisheshika scheme.
Yeah, it seems that they built the philosophy on something which is correct, but then they speculated on...
Oh yeah, I'm sure there are Vedic roots of a lot of what's going into this and other philosophies, yes.
One of Baladev Vidyabhushana's main arguments against them is that they say that the atoms have no, in the Vedanta Sutra, or Vyasadev's, that they say that the atoms have no size, and how would such atoms give rise to the world, which has size? So that's like one...
Yeah.
And Srila Prabhupada
even,
also...
Even three atoms put together are supposed to be visible.
Yeah. In the 10th canto, Srila Prabhupada writes about it, that also this idea that the jivas have no size or that they're infinite in size, it's ridiculous, because then it would mean that Krishna would, or the Supreme would have no way of controlling these infinite beings in the prayers.
Because if they have no size, that Krishna can't control them?
If they have an infinite size. Because according to Vaisheshika, the jivas are infinite in size.
Infinite in size.
Yeah.
The mind is atomic in the Vaisheshika philosophy, but the jiva is infinite in size.
Yeah.
Well, Krishna could still control. Krishna's controlling, you know, infinite things also. He's controlling time, which is infinite. Yeah.
I think Prabhupada probably just gives this to show, like, yes, this is ridiculous.
Yeah, yes. Thank you. Satish Prabhu?
I heard Baladev Vidyabhushana, he's explaining his commentary on Vedanta Sutra.
Yes.
I'm not sure about, but Chaitanya means Paramananda or Param Tattva. Chaitanya, he giving a definition of Chaitanya.
Of Chaitanya?
Yeah. So, my question is, why he not explaining something about Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in his commentary or this thing?
Oh. So, I don't know where he's doing it and what purpose he's doing it for. I have to see the context. But generally, the early Goswamis were hoping that even though we're all followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, there are other Vaishnavas who are not. And they were hoping that the books they wrote, like the Hari Bhakti Vilas, which is a Vaishnav Smriti, like the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, the authors were hoping that Vaishnavas and other sampradayas would take advantage of their books also. So therefore, they didn't, in their textbooks, they didn't talk too much about Lord Chaitanya, just to maybe get a more general audience.
In Maharashtra, I read some books, or other scholars also, they are arguing like this. They accept in Gaurang Mahaprabhu, but they are not considered as Chaitanya and Gauranga Mahaprabhu same, and they're giving, like, arguing...
That Gauranga Mahaprabhu is someone else other than Chaitanya?
Yeah, he's not accepting Chaitanya, means they are considering, like, they're giving example of this, whatever Baladev Vidyabhushana explained in his commentary,
yes,
the definition of Chaitanya, and they're, how to say...
Oh, I can't see how that's a proof that Gauranga Mahaprabhu is not the same as Lord Chaitanya.
Maybe you
because read. You're discussing what the word Chaitanya means as a common noun. You know, the word means both. It's somebody's name, but it also means consciousness. And it meant that before he appeared. Before he appeared, the Mayavadis were using the word Chaitanya to refer to you know, pure consciousness. It's valid to, you know, if you're talking about, you know, in some place in the Vedanta Sutra where it's just talking about kind. The Vedanta Sutra is not talking about Lord Chaitanya. If you're explaining Vedanta Sutra, why drag Lord Chaitanya into it? So it's not a, I don't know what kind of, maybe they have some other argument, but that's not much of an argument to prove that Mahaprabhu was someone other than this Chaitanya.
Because one book is Indian Sant, and there is a situation in Tukaram Maharaj.
Yes.
You know maybe about Tukaram Maharaj.
Tukaram?
Yeah, from yes. Maharashtra.
Yes.
So this Indian Sant, this book in English.
Yes.
And
no, Tukaram is somebody current? Not the original Tukaram.
Yeah, original Tukaram about.
Okay, yes.
So he's speaking about his parampara means about he explaining
his own parampara.
Chaitanya,
yes.
Yeah. And this author is describing how is Tukaram is not disciple of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's.
Mean yeah. Some other Chaitanya? That Tukaram mentions Chaitanya as one of his predecessors?
Yeah.
And then someone's arguing that it's not the Bengali Chaitanya. Can't be Bengali, forget it.
Yeah. And I think this book is published in 1927, this
yes.
book. So it means this is argument before 80 years also.
Yes.
Tukaram is disciple of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu or not?
But that's just prejudice. I think mainly because Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was Bengali, and it's just a regional disagreement. Just like the people here, they don't like Bengalis too much, and therefore they're not so attracted to the Gaudiya Sampradaya because we're Bengali Sampradaya. That's just prejudice. I don't know if we can see what their arguments are. I don't think they're too substantial. Okay. Anyway, that's a little off course. Anything concerning today's Anuchet? Okay, if not, we'll stop for now and we'll move on tomorrow. Yes, Urdhavabhu.
I'm asking about Sant Tukaram. You know, means who is real guru of you read about him or something?
Okay, the class is over now. We have general discussion. Yes, who?
About Sant Tukaram Maharaj.
It's Tukaram. No, I don't know. But Prabhupada says something about Lord Chaitanya's influence on him. Prabhupada's opinion given in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Is that he did get Lord Chaitanya's association. Doesn't say he was initiated by him, but he was inspired by Lord Chaitanya.
But time is not, same time.
I don't know the time. When did Tukaram live?
He just, he in 16th century, or 17th. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is 15th
century. Okay. Oh, okay. Yes. Who? Yeah, who's saying it?
Himself is saying, yeah. Himself is saying like this.
Yes. Well,
I have a different question, Prabhu.
Yeah, okay, but then he must have been in a dream because he couldn't have lived at the same time.
Okay. About that Dharma Projita Kaitavatra Parma, I have one question. What is the meaning of Dharma Projita Kaitavatra?
Projita Kaitava is a Bahuvrihi Samas. So it's an adjective explaining what kind of Dharma. The Dharma is the religious principles Atra in this book. So in this book, the religious principles that are talked about will be dharma, projita kaitava. That means kicking out everything cheating. That's what kind of religious principles will be discussed in the Bhagavatam.
I have a question like this now. Perfect question is, projita kaitava dharma means before there is some like this dharma are there, projita kaitava dharma in Bhagavatam?
You, not in Bhagavatam, but in other books. You can say that Karmakanda is Kaitava. You can say that Advaitavad is Kaitava.
But you say
Sridhar Swami says all kinds of, Kshira Swami says that, the karma, jnana, and even the desire for liberation are all kaitava. Mm. Sridhar Swami's opinion, not Jiva Goswami, but Sridhar Swami.
Yeah. But this shloka, especially for Bhagavatam, you know, is like you said.
Yes, so Vyasadeva presented the Karmakanda and the Jnanakanda. Mm-hmm. And the Bhagavatam is making a bold statement. It's comparing itself to the Karmakanda and Jnanakanda. That in the Karmakanda and Jnanakanda there is Kaitava Dharma. But that Kaitava Dharma is excluded from the Bhagavatam. You will find Jugupsitam Dharma Kate Nushasita. That's what Narada said. This is disgusting. This is contemptible that you've instructed people in inferior things that they're going to be attached to. So if Narada is considering it Kaitava, the Karmakanda and Jnanakanda. Naishkarmiyam achyuta bhava varjitam na shobhate. It's not very nice. This jnana without bhakti. That's Kaitava. Promotion of karma, of jnana, of yoga, of mukti is Kaitava if it doesn't really aim at promotion of pure devotional service. And all the other books that Vyasadeva compiled before the Bhagavatam, they contain this Kaitava. So therefore the Bhagavatam is saying this is not like the other books. That's what it's saying.
From beginning they never gave a chance to any Kaita Dharma in Bhagavatam, you know. Is pure
that
promise.
Is the promise. You know, that's the sankalpa. If the Bhagavatam fails to do that, then you can criticize the Bhagavatam for that. But the Bhagavatam is claiming that we're going to avoid all the Kaitava. Sankalpa in the beginning.
To tell you frankly, I didn't grasp most of what was said in here.
Oh my God! Should we do it all over again?
No.
Okay.
But I'll
Can we? What
I'll
didn't
ask
you?
Specific questions.
Okay, we got a few minutes. Go ahead.
Vaishnava authors also use some Vaisheshika concepts like samayavana to analyze physical existence, even though Bhadarayana Vedavyasa.
Okay, we're knocking. You know, Jiva Goswami is putting down Vaisheshika as something bad. So we're, you know, to just balance it a little bit. We do admit that we do use Vaisheshika concepts and methodology to some extent.
But what is this sentence? The following invalidity of conceiving the inherence as a special kind of relationship distinct from the more basic relationships of inclusion and contact.
Well, in the second chapter of the Vedanta Sutra, Vyasadeva defeats all opposing philosophies. Okay, all contrary opinions about the absolute that don't agree with the real message of the Upanishads. One of the first ones that Vyasadeva attacks is Vaisheshika philosophy. For not presenting a proper view of reality. And what he pins them on is this concept of inherence. He says it's an invalid concept. It doesn't work. There's no way that real things can have such a relationship. And he gives argument. I didn't present the argument here, but that's what I'm talking about.
And can you briefly explain this?
He's rejecting the authority of Vaisheshika's view of reality, and he's specifically attacking this one concept of their concept of samavaya.
What's the ultimate goal of this philosophy of Vaisheshika?
I don't know. I haven't studied the Vaisheshika sutras. In the beginning of the Nyaya sutras, Nyaya school and Vaisheshika school are so close that they later on merged into one school, Nyaya Vaisheshika. Later authors belong to, don't distinguish one school from the other because they fit, you know, like a hand in a glove. Nyaya is the methods of logic, like the epistemology, how do you know anything? And going along with that, how do you know, there's what you know. What is there real? So we use the techniques of how you know. You apply them to decide what is reality. And the what is reality part, the ontology, that's the Vaisheshika. So they go very close together and they don't contradict one another. So later on, the authorities, so the two schools merged into one later on. I said that because Gautama says that by understanding the 16, he says 16 elements of logic, not logic, but of pramana in general, knowing. By understanding them, you will attain nikshreyasa, the highest goal of life. And the commentaries, the early commentaries on Nyaya Sutras identify that as mukti. So it's supposed to be aiming at mukti. But Nyaya's view of what is mukti is that the jiva must give up all his material qualities, all his accidental qualities. But consciousness is also one of those qualities. So a liberated jiva should have no consciousness.
It's like shunyavadi.
Not shunyavadi. He's there, but he's like a dead stone, a liberated jiva. Not like he's nothing, but he's like a dead stone, no consciousness. But that's what they're aiming at, that kind of liberation. At least the Nyaya school presented it originally like that. You're supposed to perfect your life and become liberated and lose everything, including consciousness, by studying this philosophy and deeply meditating on it.
And this is different from Sankhya? Sankhya?
Yeah, because Sankhya is a whole different analysis.
Okay, it's the question of analysis.
Yeah, well, it's just a question of what system they set up to explain reality. So they explain reality in a whole different way, Sankhya philosophy. The Sankhya we learn from Lord Kapiladeva, that's pretty straightforward, and it's actually no different from Vedanta philosophy. But the atheist Sankhya is quite peculiar. In the atheist Sankhya philosophy, the Purusha is conscious, but not active. He doesn't do anything. And nature is active, but not conscious. So it's different. You know, that's not the way we see it. And they develop all sorts of unusual ideas that we can't agree with, Sankhya philosophy.
But this Sankhya, this later Sankhya that you spoke about, is that the one that's paired with the yoga?
Yes.
Okay.
We don't have the original Sankhya Sutras. We have the oldest book we have in that school, in the atheist school that we still have, was written in the first century AD. The Sankhya Karakas by Ishvara Krishna. We have something called Sankhya Sutras. They were obviously written very late, maybe the 18th century. They're a forgery. They're not the original Sankhya Sutras. According to Puranas, the atheist Sankhya appeared in the descendant of sage Agnyavesha. So, you know, he's an ancient sage. But what we have now is obviously not the original sutras written by that ancient sage. Upstairs, you can see, we've got an English translation if you want to see what Sankhya philosophy is about.
Well, it seems that more or less the transition is still existing, even though...
Well, yeah, the ideas are being presented, but we don't have the original sutras.
I had another question about the text, the purport.
Okay, about the purport.
The sentence... these goals, material progress and science, are detrimental when they pose as the actual goal of life.
Okay.
And when spiritual culture is earnest to their jaded purposes. This last sentence, when spiritual culture is earnest to their jaded purposes. Can you explain another word?
Yeah. The real purpose of life for the materialists is power and enjoyment. And technology is one, you know, the Vaisheshikas had their way of conquering nature, and modern materialists use technology, which is based on modern science. And they also have a place for religion. You know, a good materialist should go to church on Sunday and act upright and be considered a good citizen. You know, by being religious, you know, religion from Dharma comes Artha. Religion is good business. So they have material purposes for their religious life. jaded. It means, you know, I guess it's a fancy word, but it just means, you know, not very pure and not very substantial purposes.
Diverted?
Diverted?
Yeah, jaded.
That's like, that's what jaded means. Jaded means like old and crummy and, yeah. Like, in, you know, an old lady is 50 years old, not, you know, 60 years old, not very attractive anymore. That's jaded. Yeah. Okay. Or a jaded idea is just, you know, the idea has been around for so long, no one takes it seriously any longer. That's a jaded idea. So materialism, everyone's been trying it since time immemorial. You know, don't they realize that it doesn't work? So that's jaded. They're just trying the same thing over and over again foolishly. Yeah, chewing the chewed, that's jaded. Okay, we'll stop here. Thank you, all glories to Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.